Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Growing up with family violence, Jackie says it was in the stars that she ended up leading the largest peak body in Australia for organisations and individuals who work with men to end family violence. Over her 8 years as CEO of No to Violence, Jackie saw the organisation grow from a team of 20 in Melbourne to more than 90 staff across 5 states. No to Violence offer a men's referral service and is a central point of contact for men taking responsibility for their violent behaviour. They also work with the family violence sector and governments to develop and advocate for best practice policy in stopping men's use of family violence, as well as providing training and workforce development for sector workers. Since this episode, it should be noted that Jackie has stepped down as CEO from No to Violence, but nonetheless, we thank you, Jackie, for a very interesting and insightful chat.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of Pebble in the Pond. I'm your host, Talitha Natt, and this morning I'm sat here with the lovely Jackie Watts at the Stop Domestic Violence Conference on the Gold Coast. Good morning, Jackie.
Morning, Talitha.
Nice to have you here with us. I was just mentioning to you that the feedback from your presentation yesterday has been exceptional, and the feedback from our delegates went along the lines of, you know, it was incredibly moving, engaging and insightful. So I was hoping that you might be able to share some of the key takeaways that you presented yesterday to our listeners, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay. Well, I'm delighted that people enjoyed the presentation. And we also got some questions and answers, which I always think is the best thing to do at a conference. You get some engagement from the room. That makes it a bit more real. Look, I think I was just trying to present how we do the work with men and what we've learned over the 30 years of trying to do that at No to Violence, which is we've learned a lot of things and we have a lot of expertise, but we by no means have all the answers. And I think maybe because I also told a little bit of my own story in that, I think that enables you to connect with your audience a bit more. And given that in our work, in the Stop Domestic Violence work that we're all trying to do, only about 40% of people in our workforces have had some direct experience of domestic or sexual or family violence themselves. So it's important people have the chance to connect. And of course, I went on after the wonderful Geraldine Bilston and her colleague from Victoria. And so they had set the scene for how do we actually really bring lived experience and lived expertise into the work far more meaningfully. And so I had a hard act to follow. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I need to tell a little bit of my story as well.
You're so right when you say that sharing stories connects each other, mostly obviously to ourselves, but also to the people in the room that are listening. Would you mind perhaps sharing a bit of your story with our listeners in terms of what drove you into working in the No to Violence space?
Well, it's interesting because I think when I joined No to Violence, which is almost 8 years ago now, I don't think it was spoken about how people were bringing their lived experience into work. It was almost maybe shunned even a little bit to talk about it. And I don't think I realized until a little bit of time after I was in the role that I probably was always going to come and do this role at some point in my life. Mm. And that actually my childhood experience had been pretty fundamental in getting me to this spot. So my father was a violent man. He was a very heavy drinker and we had a pretty tough time as kids. And my mom certainly had a very tough time with him as a partner. They were married for 27 years, I think, before they separated. 6 children in our family. I'm the fifth. So the fifth girl. I was also meant to be a boy.
Really?
I think they were expecting a boy and they had two boys' names ready. And when the girl came out, they went, oh, so go figure. But there's definitely some destiny, I think, in how I found myself in this role at Not of Islands. Mm. The truth is, neither my dad nor my mum could get any help anywhere. Mm. There were no refuges, so mum couldn't leave. If she did try to leave, she wanted to take the kids with her. That would have been far too disruptive. And he got away with it, basically. And even when the police were called, as it was, we had a police officer at the top of the road that I lived in. He would pop down and he would sit down and have a dram with my dad and say, they're there, try not to do that again. But nobody was paying any attention to what was happening for my mom or for the kids, mm-hmm. for that matter. So that's the backdrop. Mm. But I also discovered many, many years later, and I didn't get to say this yesterday, my dad and my mom met during the Second World War.
Right.
So they were both in uniforms. He was in the Navy. He was a fisherman, but he was also a sailor. So he was on the Navy ships and she was in the ATS. And when they met, it's a different period in history, isn't it?
Mm.
Many years later, so my dad was 67 when he died, which isn't old, but he did really abuse his body very severely during his 67 years. I was talking to his last remaining living sister a few years ago and I said, look, what actually happened during the war? What did Dad get up to during the war? And she said, oh, I can tell you a few stories. And we'd always been told as children he never saw any active service. And that was the end of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Turns out he was on the minesweepers. And of course, they were pulling bodies out of the Irish Sea. They were blowing up German U-boats underneath and pulling out these young men who were the same age as him. He was 21, mm-hmm. Pulling dead bodies out of the sea. So that's pretty traumatic. Mm-hmm. But also another thing that had happened was that he had found himself in sick bay this day. He wasn't well. And the ship that he'd been on for a few weeks went out into the Irish Sea and hit two mines colliding. And none of those boys came back.
God.
So he'd been on a ship with, hundreds of guys. And then suddenly they're just all gone. So none of that excuses his behaviour.
Mm.
But it's context.
Yes.
And it was untreated trauma that didn't get spoken about, didn't get dealt with, and that did express itself through explosive violence. It wasn't like coercive control or psychological game playing or systematic bit-by-bit undermining. It was explosive violence when he just couldn't handle things and he took it out on all the people around him.
Right. Can we delve into the work that Not of Islands does? Obviously, it's a space that you're incredibly passionate about, and I think that came through particularly in your presentation yesterday. And for our listeners who may not know about Not of Islands, could you tell us about, I guess, how the organisation was founded and your role as CEO?
Great, yeah, no problem. So we have been in existence for almost 30 years, so watch this space in 2023. We will be finding ways of marking and celebrating our 30-year anniversary. Not of Islands actually started as two separate organisations. One of them is the Men's Referral Service, which does the telephone counselling work with mine directly. So it started with a group of volunteers getting together and saying, we need to do something about this terrible situation, and staffing a phone line. That's how it started. Mm-hmm. And now it is a national helpline available 7 days a week across the whole of Australia on 1300 766 491. We have well-trained counsellors ready and willing to take the call. We can refer men on to our own counselling services or in services in their area. We also have a housing project that we're operating in Victoria only at the moment, where we can take the man out of the family home rather than insisting that the partner and children leave, and offer him time-limited housing on the basis that he does some work with us mm-hmm. on his behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very much a pilot, and we're evaluating that as we go. We're excited about that. So, and as well as that, we have workers based in courts. So we have workers based in the family court. So they will meet a man when he comes in, and it might be a contested hearing. It might be that, he's in a state of complete escalation and rage, and our workers will work to calm him down, explain the legal process, and make sure that that court hearing goes well on the basis that it's easier for her and the kids if he's behaving well in the courtroom. So the lawyers and the judges have told us that's a fabulous service. I'm really pleased to do that. So all of those things I've just described as our services.
Mm-hmm.
Way. In addition to that, we have a membership base. We operate as a peak body across Australia, and we provide advocacy, policy and strategy advice to our members, but also to governments to say, if you want to really do something about the people using violence, come and talk to us, because we know a thing or two, and we can help you think about your policy and your funding settings, and you can treat us as a trusted advisor in that. Plus, of course, we fight for funding for our members all the time, at every budget submission and all the rest of it. So that's the peak work. And then mm-hmm. the third wing of the organisation is our training and workforce development. And that's where we support people getting the specialist skills to do the work we mine safely, because it's complex.
Yes.
It's not straightforward. There's lots of pitfalls. So we've been building up that workforce development offerings now over a number of years. And we're doing loads of different stuff in all sorts of places. But for example, we're working with Victoria Police to assist them in thinking about how they, it's not just the cultural management, but it's also what happens when you have perpetrators. Mm-hmm. Within the uniform services.
Mm-hmm. Interesting work. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So for our listeners, would you mind explaining, I guess, the process? So from the minute that someone, a gentleman, for example, picks up the phone and calls No to Violence, what is the average process from the minute that phone call takes place through to an ideal end result or resolution?
I think that's one of the challenges of this work, is it's very, very hard to actually describe it in a linear process.
Right.
If we were dealing with widgets or making something, it would be, you know, a different story. But I can tell you what the kind of example of a typical call might be.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And also what we then offer that person. So I guess what I was saying yesterday as well was that the journey of change is a hard one, and it's not a straight line. I often say to when I get asked this question, you know, how many times do you think Nick Cave went to rehab before he got sober and clean? Mm-hmm. It certainly was more than one.
Yes.
So sometimes it is a start-stop thing. But if the call comes in, it's often he's calling because he's got some issues going on in court, or we're calling him because the police have given us a referral, or his partner or his family or his kids have said, for God's sake, do something about this. We can't live with this anymore. So at some level, he's got some kind of mandate to make the call. Mm-hmm. He will often be stressed, feeling that everybody's against him. The courts are against him, the cops are against him, she's against him. Or when I say she, I mean, this also happens in non-heteronormative relationships. This happens in bi, lesbian, gay, bisexual communities, you know, transgender. The violence is in every potential relationship. Mm. So people will call and say, it's, you know, it's not my fault, I didn't really do it. So we will work to unpack that and say, okay, so you say that you only punched the wall, and I'm quoting this is a physical violence example. Mm-hmm. You say you only punched the wall and you didn't hit her, but I wonder what that was like for her. So we're constantly trying to bring the other partner, the other party to the proceedings, into his consciousness and saying, well, I wonder what that was like for the kids. Oh, well, the kids are sleeping upstairs. You're like, kids hear things, you know, kids see things. I wonder what that's like for them. So constantly trying to take him out of his own kind of rumination, if you like, going around in circles and coming back to, okay, so what's the actual situation? And then get to a space to say, well, what can we do about this? Mm-hmm. You know, are you open to going to services? Are you open to speaking to somebody else about this at a deeper level? We can offer you that if you wish. We can refer you to our brief intervention service, or we can refer you to a men's behavior change program. Now, the challenge with that is that there's a waiting list.
Right. Yeah?
So there's just not enough men's behavior change programs in Victoria, never mind in Australia, to go around. And also, I think we need to look at different types of interventions in that space. So for us, it's about trying to keep him on the phone, keep him listening, keep him thinking about it, knowing that he can call anytime, he can call back. And, you know, the intention is obviously to make the situation at home safer. That's our entire purpose. We know that this journey for men is a hard one. And we also know that a lot of the people that we really need to get to and be aware of and have sight of in our society, they're not going to phone our helpline.
Mm.
So, you know, Rowan Baxter, I quote, you know, is not the kind of guy that would ever have phoned our help, because he didn't think there was anything wrong with him. So, you know, that's why the work we do has to be more than just that direct one-to-one or group work with men. It has to be that broader societal change that enables people to say to their mates or their partners or their friends, I think you're in a bit of bother here. I think this guy's really controlling.
Yep.
What's that like for you?
Yes.
Do you feel safe? You know, and really raise the consciousness of people around the person experience and the control.
I think it's about the education and awareness piece that is so important for individuals and communities to know what to look for or know what type of questions to ask if they do have concerns around a family member or friends or colleagues, for example. Tell us about your journey as a CEO. I believe this is your third CEO role. Am I correct in saying that? Fantastic. I'd love for you to share some lessons you have learned along the way when it comes to managing people and creating positive outcomes that you work towards in your space.
Wow, such a great opportunity to have a think about that. Yeah, it scares me when I think, gosh, I've been doing this for 17 years. It's like, what? Mm. Oh, look, I think the thing about working with people is you never quite know how it's going to go. And, you know, I do try and work with a great deal of direction and passion in the work. That suits some people, doesn't suit others. My first job was in Scotland, and it was a peak body as well, and it was a housing peak body. And we had something like 200 members across Scotland, all of whom wanted a bit of me when it came to them renewing their subscriptions. All of whom got their subscription invoice and said, oh, that's too much money. We got to get this CEO to come and talk to us. Well, there was no way that I could get to 180 members in a three-month period. So you had to manage all those expectations. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of the work is about managing expectations. I feel a lot of it's about massaging egos,
yes.
coaxing people along, trying to get people to work as a team. But also more increasingly now, I think I've got more confident after these years of saying to people, look, you're just not working together.
Mm.
What's going on here?
Mm.
And actually naming it, because people take positions up. So when you're in a leadership and authority position, people project all sorts of stuff at you. You know, I'm the mom, I'm the dad, I'm the nasty head teacher, you know, the evil stepmother, the wicked witch. Particularly, so I think when women take up power and authority, we need to do it in a clean way.
Mm.
And everything we've been taught, everything that's ingrained in us, teaches us to kind of go around the houses a bit, maybe be, you know, be tempted to manipulate a bit more or whatever. I think we need to breed a whole new generation
mm.
of young, confident mm-hmm. female leaders
yeah.
who can talk to their own power and deal with conflict and deal with it in an open and a clean way. And that's really tricky.
Yeah.
And when also we're working in a sector where the predominant narrative is about, you know, men doing terrible things to mm-hmm. women,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people in our sector are still coming from that space of that lived experience, some of the time that might get in the way mm-hmm. of them being able to be clear about their own authority. So I think naming those things that your team, doing the leadership development work, both people around you, men, women and others, and really talking about, well, what kind of leadership do we want? What's our values in this organization and how do we take that up? I love the title of your conference, Creating the Change,
mm.
you know, because we really should be creating the change we want to see in the world.
Yes.
So, you know, if our business in the world in this job is making men accountable, how do we hold ourselves accountable?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I've had good and bad experiences as a CEO with boards.
Right.
You know, I think you have to make a lot of mistakes with boards to get to that point of confidence where you can go, okay, I think I've got this. I think I can read this person and I can see what's happening here. And always also you have to not take it personally.
Mm, that's such a hard thing to do though, isn't it?
Yeah. Very hard. Yeah. I'm not pretending I've got that right, Talitha, but I'm working at it.
Yeah.
No, it's not personal. When you get an attack on your authority or your leadership or, you know, the fact you've got more power than somebody else,
mm-hmm.
people are attacking that from a perspective of them struggling with that themselves.
Mm.
Oh, look, sometimes it can be personal, let's be honest, but not taking it personally enables you to go into that wider framing of what's happening here, there's a struggle here, what's going on, and what does the organization need? So, you know, I think what I've got better at is thinking, well, what do I need? Because I have to work on that all the time. But what does the organization need now? What's the best outcome for the organization?
Mm.
So, you know, you put yourself in 150% to these jobs, but gee, I've learned a lot.
And on that note, I was having a look at your history in terms of working in senior fields within alcohol and drugs and mental health and disability, social housing and social enterprise, to name a few. And it's pretty evident that I guess your passion lies in helping people and helping communities. I'm wondering, did you always have this inner knowing as a young child or young adult that this is the space that you really wanted to work in?
It's a good question. No, I don't think I did.
Right.
I mean, I think when I did my degree, I did a social policy degree, graduated in 1984, and I had no idea. I knew I needed to earn money because I had, you know, student debt, and I'd done social policy. So obviously I was interested in that whole idea of, you know, how do you create social change? And certainly my mother was a huge influence mm-hmm. on me because she'd grown up in very poor circumstances in Glasgow
right.
in the 1920s, and she had survived, you know, the depression and all the childhood illnesses that were, you know, infant mortality was 35%.
Oh, wow.
In Scotland at the time. So one in three kids were dying before they were 5 years old. So she had a big thing about people have a right to housing, they have a right to health. You know, she was very left-wing in her views. Her and Vladimir Lenin would have got on pretty well, I reckon. But that's, you know, that was kind of instilled into me. So I think it's kind of come through maybe just as I've gone from thing to thing in my career, it's kind of come through a bit stronger later in life. And certainly this job for me is both personal and political.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, the work that you do would take a lot of energy and output and effort. And you just said earlier that you have to give 150% to your job. How do you motivate yourself every day to show up as that leader that needs to be, I guess, leading people, leading that change, leading the conversation, but most of all yourself?
Yeah, no, it's very challenging sometimes. And look, I think COVID coming along, and we've all been impacted by COVID. Like the last 2.5 years have been probably the toughest in the role, because you're trying to do it online. And I'm a people person. I like real people and being able to see them and touch them and look them in the eye and pick up some of the nuances of, you know, what's going on with them, because that's, I need all that data in order to respond appropriately. So I found that really, really tough going. I'm an extrovert, and being stuck at home in front of a computer was not the best thing. Plus, it piled on the kilos. So we're dealing with that now, dealing with the consequences.
Oh, look, I think
now.
We all are, the post-COVID expansion.
Yeah. But, you know, I've been told, even when I was a kid, I've been told I couldn't sit still, and I was always restless. And so I think I do have a high degree of energy when it comes to working with people and through people. And I think the cause is worth getting behind. But also, you've got to remember, and I've got to remember, that, you know, I have a life as well.
Yes.
And I can't be defined, a bit like what Geraldine said yesterday, not to be just defined by the role that people see you in, and to get to a stage where you can think, okay, so what's next?
Yeah.
What's next on the agenda?
It's nice to have that foresight in terms of looking forward to things coming up next year. I know you mentioned you've got quite a big year coming up with Nota, which is very exciting for you, and I look forward to watching this space. One final question for you. What would be one piece of advice you would like to share with our listeners if they too are looking to explore working within advocacy or policy within their communities?
Well, look, come and talk to us. That
yeah,
would be great.
Idea.
We'd really delighted to come and talk to us. We've got a graduate certificate, I should also say, in male family violence. If people are interested in taking the specialist qualification further, we offer the graduate certificate. We've done that for up nearly 20 years now. So that's the specialist qualification. But advocacy in your communities, look, it's about starting the conversation, I think. And I think often too, maybe some kind of mentor or guide to support you, because it's within all of us to do powerful, powerful things in our lives and in our communities. So I would just say, think about the thing, the change you want, find out what's going on around that in your area or out there, and get close to people who can support you in that, because change is difficult, but change is possible.
Absolutely. That's a great piece of advice. Thank you so much, Jackie. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.